a host of unemployed citizens face the grim problem of existence, and an equally great number toil with little return.
Our economy is in turmoil, and the American promise has been threatened once more. Tonight, more Americans are out of work, and more are working harder for less. More of you have lost your home.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, I'm afraid, you know, I don't see that the U.S., even with another stimulus package, could rescue itself, because most of their industrial capacity have already been, you know, depleted. It has gone overseas. So I don't think there's much industry really to stimulate back into life. And the other thing is, unlike China, who do have a lot of cash, who do have very low government debt, and so it's easy for them to splash out some cash. But in the United States, there's already a funding crisis, and they will have to sell a lot more bonds next year to fund the bailout packages that have already been signed off. And so I think the U.S. might be on course to actually lose AAA rating, you know, But I think actually, you know, the U.S. might really have to look at a default and a bankruptcy reorganization of the present financial system. You had almost seen the banks fail. Now I think the next thing that might happen is a bankruptcy of the government, again, in the United States and a number of European countries.
In this program, our second interview with Dmitry Orlov, author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Experience and American Prospects, plus veteran journalist Paul Gillen on newspapers set to disappear in a city near you, The Financial Tsunami with Mad Max Kaiser, and the usual cast of cartoon characters. I'm Alex Smith, and the time has come. General Motors is worthless. Stores in the malls are closing even before Christmas. American Express needs a credit card from Uncle Sam just to survive. It looks bad. And who better to help us out than Dmitry Orlov, author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example, and American Prospects. Dmitry, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be with you.
You know, our last interview was picked up by at least 40 radio stations. Here's my big question for you this time. Dmitry, what the hell is happening to us?
Well, we are in the final stages of financial collapse, and we are in the early stages of commercial collapse. We still have this idea that that we might be able to bail out various parts of the commercial sector. And we still have the idea that the government is capable of doing something, and that one of these things is spending money. Now, it turns out that the government actually doesn't have any money, and as a lender of last resort, what is being sacrificed is the solvency of the U.S. government. And I would think that on a fairly short timeline, perhaps a year, perhaps two, it will become apparent that the U.S. government is insolvent.
Wow. I visited your blog at cluborlov.blogspot.com, and I saw you just spoke along with John Michael Greer at the 5th Annual Community Solutions Conference. What was that conference about?
The conference was mostly about things that people could do, adjustments that they could make to their lives. Some of it was very common sense stuff, such as, you know, super insulating your house to be able to afford the heating bills. Some of it was about alternative forms of transportation. I talked about sailing, making use of sailing vessels that we have on hand to make up for the coming shortages of diesel fuel, which will make trucking very expensive and sometimes impossible. There were some efforts in the direction of putting together smart jitney programs so that people don't have to drive. You know, we can quadruple or even quintuple the efficiency of the cars that exist today just by making sure that there is full occupancy, that there are no free seats in any of the cars on the road when they're moving. So those are all fairly common sense, small, perhaps, shy moves in the right direction. I hope that, you know, people take that sort of thing seriously, because it makes sense to go through things like that, even if it's just a you know, a training exercise.
Last January, you explained that there were five stages of collapse, and would it bore you too much to explain it again to our listeners? Because I think we really need to hear it now.
Yes. Well, the five stages is what I talked about in my keynote address at the conference. The stage that we are in the final part of now is financial collapse. Basically, the assumptions of endless economic growth and the assumptions that money will be worth something, that we can conserve value by investing it in productive capacity of some sort, that all of that is being negated as we speak. Right now, there's still this idea that there might be bailouts for, you know, for American Express, for credit card companies. A lot of that comes down to basically canceling debts. You know, debt forgiveness is what I advocated to start with. If everybody, you know, realized that these debts are unrepayable no matter what anyone does, it would have been possible to unwind the debt pyramid without incurring these crippling liabilities on behalf of the United States government. But that's really what's happening. We have now, you know, extra few trillion dollars of unrepayable government public debt. So that's the first stage. And the second stage is what we're beginning to see, which is commercial collapse, basically deliveries failing to happen and retail outlets closing. People losing access, so that even if they have money, they can't spend it, because there's nowhere to spend it. At some point, it will become very difficult to get deliveries of any sort to take place. So everything will start to be based on existing inventory and things that can be scavenged in the immediate vicinity. And on the heels of that, we'll probably have political collapse, because what will happen is, you know, government in the United States is very dependent on finance. It can't really get very much done without access to money, without borrowing. In some states, notably in California, there's a stopgap borrowing between when they spend the money and when they get taxes in, that if it doesn't take place, suddenly their budgets evaporate and absolutely essential things like garbage removal, for instance, will fail to take place. Of course, what is already happening is bridges and roads and various other pieces of infrastructure are beyond what can be maintained given the new fiscal realities. So we're going to have a lot of impassable roads. A lot of smaller population centers might end up cut off and might require long detours to get to. So those are all things that are off in the distance. But right now there is a lot of hope that the government can make a difference for the better. And, you know, some of that may be realistic, but I don't think that the financial levers of control are actually attached to anything on the other end anymore. So it's more a question of gesturing than of actually impacting what is happening.
Unfortunately, I agree with you. These days, it feels like that sort of phony war they had in 1939. The war had been declared, but there was no fighting for almost a year. Well, you know, now our commercial system appears to be collapsing, but the malls are still full of gear. It's surreal. But I'm hearing the shipping is more or less stopped, you know, and even in American ports and the Greek lines going bust. And that means a lag time of several months to a year before some of these imported products start to disappear off the shelves, although it's already happening now in Iceland, I'm told. Do you think it's worth trying to prepare ourselves personally by stocking up on food and supplies?
Well, yes and no. I think it makes sense to have a few months' worth of supply, although it doesn't provide for fresh food, which is absolutely essential. You can, of course, you know, do simple things like sprout beans, for instance, to ward off scurvy. But, you know, canned and frozen food is a mixed blessing at best. It can be used to basically ride out the immediate aftermath of commercial collapse, because with it comes a lot of anger Hoarding and looting, the looting is sort of an antidote to hoarding, and hoarding is what happens when, a market economy runs out of, key commodities. So it's best to not have to participate. And if you have, some resources of your own, not a huge hoard, but enough to survive, then it may make it possible to spare yourself a lot of unpleasantness. Now, after that period, I think it will become very, very important for people to figure out ways to gain access to food. And it could be any number of things. I know the things that I would naturally do, which is like pick mushrooms. Because, this is something that I can do because most people I know can't tell a poisonous mushroom from a non-poisonous mushroom. I can. So the forests are mine, mine and, the other Russians, of course, will be there in hordes doing the same thing because they all are competent mushroom pickers. But, that's a resource that I can make use of. Other people can do similar things. Other people can fish, for instance, or they know a little bit about aquaculture and can stock a fish pond, or they're competent gardeners and they can spend a summer out in the countryside somewhere, pay a little bit to some farmer, maybe sharecrop even. Once the tractors stop moving, a lot of farmers will have nothing better to do with their with their very large fields than to basically invite people to come and visit during the summer and try to grow something. That seems like a reasonable plan. So people will have to start doing things like that because it's really about the flow of food. It's not about inventory. A stockpile of food is by definition rotten, and not very healthy. So I think that's what people should start thinking about.
Yeah, like where does food come from and how can we participate in it? Are you surprised at how quickly things are unraveling? Are there events we should watch for, warning signs, so to speak?
Yeah, surprised, disappointed. I don't get any special satisfaction from being right. I predicted these things basically by refusing to believe the fiction that everybody insisted was real. Because once you basically dismiss the idea that, oh, it looks solid, therefore it is solid, you actually start looking at what it is fundamentally, how sound it is, you basically start to see which way it's heading. It's surprising how quickly it's headed in that direction. The other thing is that, being able to predict these things and see this unraveling slightly ahead of time doesn't do me any good necessarily. Maybe there's an element of psychological preparation. I've said that before. That's helpful. It's better than being taken by surprise, but very few people are really capable of really preparing the way they should, because they're very hemmed in by the current living arrangement, and they're surrounded by people who are full of unrealistic expectations, and they have to abide by rules that are maladaptive to the future that is ready to arrive. So people are very limited in the sorts of things that they can do. If you live in a suburban neighborhood and you start putting up, little windmills that are composed of pieces of SUVs because, the SUVs aren't very useful anymore, and start collecting rainwater and start plowing up your lawn and planting, squash and corn and beans and things, your local property owners association will write you a big ticket for it, that you will be fined, and that's very typical, and it will take a while before the property owners associations are extinct, and by that time it will be too late to start doing these things. So this is all very unfortunate.
Yes, our social arrangements will slow us down. Well, we're talking with Dmitry Orlov, and one of your prescriptions for salvaging what's left in America is to close the foreign bases, just bring the troops home. And that sounded outrageous last spring, and it seems rather obvious now. I just heard the big financier Jim Rogers say the very same thing on CNBC TV this week. Isn't it strange how ideas that seem repellent suddenly morphed to become the new public dialogue? Everybody accepts it.
Well, to me, it looks like, you know, my ideas look repellent to people I find repellent, and then at some point those people shut up and I'm gratified. That's the evolution as it seems to me. It's not an evolution of ideas. It's sort of a de-evolution of a certain segment of humanity. But the idea of bringing troops home is a very obvious one. You know, right now the military is not doing anything of any particular use around the world. There's 1,000 military bases, but if they go away, it's not clear that anything around the world would change particularly. If they were brought back, the army could basically be reformed in a way that would allow it to play a positive role. The problem is that Americans need to be defended from each other at all times. They pose a greater danger to each other than most other nations. This is currently done by the police and through the outrageously high prison population because of all the unsolved social problems that have been swept under the rug for decades, sometimes for hundreds of years. And so the problem with police is that police safeguard property because their income and their budgets are based on tax receipts. So that, for instance, Beverly Hills is very well defended, and you know, Eastern Los Angeles much less so. You know, that's a typical example. The problem is that when municipal budgets more or less go away, the police become much less eager to defend people from each other and much more eager to defend themselves and their own families and look out for their own interests. So I think that the U.S. military has a big role to play in domestic peacekeeping. I think that all of these troops that are repatriated will need to be placed in various urban areas to keep the peace. And the other thing that can be done very usefully with the military is that, you know, the military is a unique organization because they just follow orders. You don't necessarily need a big budget. You don't need a recruitment arm if the people are already there. So you can basically tell them to do things like grow potatoes, like truck in dirt from the suburbs and nail together boxes in parking lots in inner cities for raised bed agriculture, like drag jersey barriers into place to block off raised highways and use them instead to put together water collection systems because there won't be any traffic anyway. All of these things can be done very efficiently and quickly by the military. And when nothing is moving because the wheels of commerce and finance are stuck in mud, the military can be the only thing that, you know, the President of the United States, federal authorities, and state authorities can call on to actually get useful things accomplished. Right now, of course, there is this ridiculously huge defense budget, but if you look at it, a lot of that gets wasted on various types of military toys, basically new ways of blowing things up, and then on mobility, mid-air refueling, transportation, long supply lines, you know, delivering three flavors of ice cream to an air-conditioned tent in the middle of the desert somewhere, all of that sort of thing. Now, that is all inessential because the soldiers can move around on the double or on bicycles. They don't actually need any form of transportation other than boots. If it's not across the world that they have to travel, but to the next county by sometime next week, you know, that's perfectly reasonable. So I think that, you know, the U.S. military is a useful resource that is right now being basically being squandered on absolutely useless foreign involvement, but can be pulled back and can be used to make life possible for people in the United States where it wouldn't be otherwise.
Well, Dimitri, I'd like to get your take on a debate running in the blogosphere these days. James Howard Kunstler and Max Kaiser are among many who expect a period of deflation, you know, where prices fall, and then a wild bout of inflation, where a hamburger could end up costing $1,000, say. And they call it the tsunami dollar. It goes out, and then it rushes back in. Do you expect inflation, or might America just go bankrupt?
I'm familiar with the tsunami metaphor, that first money goes out and there's a drop in asset prices, and then money rushes in as it's being printed because, you know, the debt has to be monetized because it can no longer be rolled over. And it makes a lot of sense to me. I think that there's a wider perspective that would be more useful, which is that money as a metaphor becomes not so useful because it's denominated in economic growth, which is dependent on fossil fuels, which are dwindling. So if you have a dollar that's denominated in oil, and an individual can very easily afford to use something that produces 100 horsepower 4 hours a day, right, which is the situation now, and suddenly they go to a situation where it's just them, and working flat out, they're putting out something like 0.2 horsepower, and they have to actually grow food and eat the food in order to even do that, then, you know, the value of the money is just not the same. And it doesn't even matter how much of it you have. It's just that everybody's poor no matter how you slice it. So the other perspective that people should have on money is, you know, there's a Russian saying, money doesn't smell. It doesn't matter where you got your money. You know, it still looks the same, and it still works the same. So you could make your money by, you know, painting paintings, or you could make your money by, you know, slaughtering dolphins, and it would still be the same money. So in general, this is a real problem that money doesn't smell. And my feeling is that if we could actually smell our money, we would be repulsed by it and would refuse to go near it. And there's a complete disconnect where, you know, people realize that the whole economic development program is in a very wrong path, you know, that we're destroying the planet, we're destroying ourselves, we're destroying society, that the whole thing is unsustainable and in crisis. And yet we're looking for ways to get a return on our investment, you know, and what we're investing in is more of the same destruction, okay? So not only do we not want to stop this destruction by pulling money out of circulation, by refusing to invest, but we want the destruction to proceed faster and faster. And I think people should stop and think about it, and there are things you can do with your money. Basically, you can refuse to invest in this economy. You can, for instance, lend it to somebody, but lend it at 0% interest. You know, the Muslim banking system. You know, and that's a step in the right direction. But the whole idea of how can we safeguard our wealth? How can we get the greatest return on investment? I think that's just a flawed approach altogether.
Really, I mean, the planet can't take the kind of growth that we've been giving it. We've run out of planet space, and we're damaging the climate as well. Well, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and you've been listening to a chat with Dmitry Orlov. I do recommend everyone get his book, Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. It will help orient you to these confusing times and give some helpful suggestions on how we can adapt. So, Dmitry, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex.
Find out more about our guest at cluborlov.blogspot.com and do get his book while you still can.
Dancing their way down the street, they have gathered in front of the White House now, 500-600 strong.
Oh, look at this. Why wait to Vic Bush now?
How come the environmentalists around the world aren't celebrating this credit contraction as a victory for the green movement?
Well, shipping has come to a complete halt.
Isn't that a victory for the green movement? I mean, you get those Greenpeace people out there trying to stop the ships from going anywhere. Well, they stopped. Shouldn't they be putting out a press release like, we won, you lost? The anti-globalization movement won. It's collapsed. Credit has collapsed. The globalization's finished. The anti-globalization movement won.
That's Max Kaiser and the lovely Miss Stacy from Karma Bank Radio. We'll be featuring their Sunday, November 10th podcast throughout this program. And good question about the Greens. If newspapers stop publishing, that's a lot of trees saved. We'll get into that with Paul Gillen in our next half hour. Americans are driving millions less miles. The last factories, like the car company, seem poised to shut down. Surely the greenhouse gases will drop, giving the planet just a couple more years' breathing space before we breach 450 parts per million and head out the door toward extinction. Maybe fewer forests will be hacked down around our remaining hideouts for biodiversity. Less minerals blasted out of the ground. A lot of this is what the planet needs, but most environmentalists hope for a better plan than total collapse of the economic system. All engineered from the top at Wall Street. Nobody's cheering when pensioners can't afford winter heat because mad bankers rode out of town with everybody's money. Nobody hoped for this. That crackling sound you hear is our near-term future going down in flames. General Electric proclaimed itself a bank this week, just before the deadline for giveaway goodies from Congress. They'll get over $100 billion in loan guarantees. Ditto American Express, which is cashing in for several billion taxpayer dollars. And General Motors, makers of the Hummer and other consumer vehicles, getting less than 15 miles to the gallon. The clunkers, with planned obsolescence and parts falling off. Oh, jeez, I feel so bad. Hey, I know. Let's give them an extra $100 billion just to keep on killing the planet, along with the electric car. I feel like getting into the car business today. Just as the human project heads over the climate horizon. Yeah, governments make great cars like the Lada and the Trabant, classic tailpipe smokers with no one to regulate the mess. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. Thanks for joining us. Let's hear a bit more from Max and Stacy as they chew over the Sunday croissant. Then we'll check out dead newspapers.
The U.S. dollar is leprosy. It's the U.S. dollar is a currency that is extremely dangerous for your wealth. I wouldn't accumulate too many of these dollars. I know right now it's experiencing a bit of a counter-trend rally, and it's tempting to be sucked into the dollar rally like the people on the Pompeii Zing Bang beach down there in the Indian Ocean were tempted to go chase the tsunami waters as they receded from the beach, only to find that, oh my God, the waters are not receding. They're just going to build up this huge wave of tsunami. I'm drowning to death. I'm drowning in the sea of dollars. And do you want to be on top of the sea of dollars or at the bottom of the sea of dollars? If you're at the bottom of the sea of dollars, you're holding dollars. You're there and you're spending freaking Zimbabwe-like hyperinflation prices for your Kotex and your tampons and your Marmite and your bazooka bubblegum and maybe a nice new plastic comb. You used to pay 39 cents. It's going to cost you $39,000. There's a huge ecological collapse. There's a huge financial collapse. As you point out, the closed system, the events on the margin, can grow into massive game-changing phenomena. You know, but going back to the tsunami example, you know, tsunamis start out miles and miles offshore, little ripples in the, you know, you wouldn't know it by looking at it that this is going to grow into a massive tsunami. And over the course of the miles it takes to reach shore, it metamorphosizes itself into a huge, huge, powerful tsunami.
In the background, CyberZen Sound Engine with Tita. Radio EcoShock will be right back after 30 seconds for station identification.
the pricing mechanism has broken. There's no price discovery. There's everything, all the numbers you see, everything is broken. And it all started from the little butterfly deception, you know, of the U.S. Like lying a little bit in the beginning about their inflation numbers, lying a little bit, therefore, about their GDP numbers, lying a little bit about how many people are unemployed.
Right.
And by the time, and you look at the charts, go to shadowstats.com, and you see the beginning of when they started to lie and massage those numbers, and it was just a little bit of difference between the reality and the perception. And then it just grew and grew and grew until it's like a monster chasm between the two numbers, the reality and the perception, or the claim by the government. So there's a huge gap between inflation numbers and that they present to you and the real inflation. This huge gap between unemployment, the huge gap with the GDP.
That's the outrageous Max Kaiser and Stacy from Karma Bank Radio. I'm Alex Smith, and welcome back to the Radio EcoShock Show. The faked government figures are fabulous, aren't they? It reminds me of old Stalinist times when the headlines announced another bumper wheat crop while there's no bread on the table. Maybe all the big systems lie until they fall over, I don't know. Newspapers might fall over too, just like the other big corporations fighting bankruptcy these days. Here at Radio EcoShock, I like an underreported story. Here's one headline you may not find in your local newspaper. The paper itself may stop coming to your door. Advertising at the television networks is crashing almost as fast as their stock values in most Western countries. It's expected to drop £200 million in Britain, for example. The American company Viacom is in trouble. The CBS network depends on TV, radio, and net ads for 70% of its income. Watch that one. Now that the election bonanza, worth a couple of $1 billion when you include all the state and local races, has just dried up, we'll see who survives until the next election cycle. But newspapers are the most endangered media species. Circulation is dropping rapidly. The big car company advertisers are cutting back or dying themselves. Real estate ads have tanked, and the public is reading less, especially young people. The American Press Institute organized 50 CEOs to meet November 13th in a quiet conference to, quote, revive the newspaper business. The Christian Science Monitor, in print for 100 years, said it will stop publishing a weekday paper and go online. The giant Time Inc., publisher of many famous magazines, is cutting 600 jobs. The biggest newspaper publisher in America, Gannett, is laying off 10% of its workforce, about 3,000 people. The Los Angeles Times is laying off another 75 people. It's about half the size it used to be just 7 years ago. As David Carr of the New York Times put it, the sky is falling. The question now is, how many people will be left to cover it? The New York Times itself carries a debt load of over $1 billion and could fall like any media giant in the current economic crash. Let's investigate with Paul Gillen. If newspapers disappear, who will report the news? For more answers, we go to Paul Gillen. Paul was a veteran print journalist. For example, he was editor-in-chief for the Tech Weekly Computer World. He's the author of a book, The New Influencers, and has started a blog called NewspaperDeathWatch.com. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, nice to be here today. Thank you.
Well, why the blog, and is it really time for a death watch for newspapers?
I started the blog because I'm interested in technology change and the implications of technology changes on existing institutions. I've noticed in over 20 years of covering the high-tech industry that very small changes in technology can often ripple through and have big changes on institutions, on markets, and on the way we live. I saw this happening in an industry that I love very much, the newspaper industry. And in 2006, I wrote an essay about what I called the coming newspaper collapse and how it would reinvent journalism. At that time, I predicted that major metropolitan newspapers would be all but dead by 2030. In fact, it's looking like it's going to happen much sooner than that. So I started the blog in early 2007 to document these changes happening in the market, primarily driven by the growth of the Internet, and have just kind of become addicted to it since then, watching not only the chaos that's happening as mainstream media is pulled apart at the seams, but also the alternatives that are beginning to emerge online.
Well, I'm thinking, too, of the Christian Science Monitor, which just announced they're going to stop their weekday print editions and go online. Do you think more newspapers will follow that route?
I certainly think they will. I think what you'll see first is that newspapers are going to start to discontinue some of their less profitable editions, the Monday, Tuesday, and Saturday editions, and then some of them will simply bite the bullet and go completely online. Unfortunately, the pain that they must go through to make that transition is pretty excruciating, so it's going to be a bitter pill for them to swallow.
Well, as you know, thousands of newspaper reporters, including some well-known investigative reporters, have lost their jobs in this process already. Who is going to report the news?
I think that there will continue to be branded entities that will do that job, such as the New York Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, will continue to survive in print as well as online. There are actually some interesting new models that are emerging online of much smaller operations that focus their news reporting on certain areas. For example, the Politico is one that runs out of Washington, D.C. and specializes in coverage of Capitol Hill and actually has gained quite a following and even partnerships with some major print publications as an outlet for its work. There's also ProPublica, which is a nonprofit that's run by the former managing editor of the Wall Street Journal that is an interesting model. And there are several citizen models that are emerging on the web. I think what will happen is that we will see individual reporters become the brands more so than the publications that they work for. So there will be journalists who will be out there making a living reporting the news, but they will be working essentially as freelancers.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about an experience I just had a few minutes ago on the Internet. I watched an interview of Al Gore from Current TV, where Gore is a major partner. And the questioner started off by plugging Mac Computers, where Gore is a director. This was supposed to be an example of new media because the questions came from the general public as rated by the online voting system DIG. But I have to tell you, Al Gore can be boring sometimes. He was here, and part of the problem was the interviewer wasn't really, experienced to push him to get some good answers, and that line between advertising and content was totally blurred. I ended up feeling that homemade democratic media might not always be so great. How do you see it?
Well, we're in the early stages of homemade democratic media, and I certainly don't believe that it's a one-to-one replacement. I do not believe for a minute that citizen journalism will replace conventional journalism as we've known it. I think that what will happen is that new economic models will need to emerge to sustain the professional journalists who will continue to be vital to the news-gathering process. The problem is that those economic models are no longer sustainable in the form of daily newspapers because of the pressures that they are under, the loss of their value as the value that they bring to the equation, to the market, is considerably less than it was before the Internet. And so I think that there will be a vacuum, certainly, while this change goes about. But I do believe in the ability of markets to step in and fill a vacuum. And so the need for quality investigative journalism will not go away. It will need to be satisfied by a different kind of media entity or different small entities who will emerge in its place. And I think I'm quite confident that those will emerge. But I think right now we're still sort of wrestling with the ongoing destruction of the traditional industry.
Well, Paul Gillen, you've got a book out called The New Influencers, and you have another new book, I'm told, in the works. So can you tell us about those?
Well, actually, I have two books out now. The second book is called Secrets of Social Media Marketing, and that is about it's a practical guide, a handbook for marketers to use in trying to work their way through this new world of Internet marketing, social media marketing. The first book, The New Influencers, was about the changes going on in markets, in the dynamics of influence in markets, as you have the emergence of millions of individual publishers using their blogs and their podcasts and such to affect markets that they care about. And markets will change dramatically as a result of having a large number of small influencers really focused on sub-segments of markets. We will look at markets differently because we now have the ability to divide them into much narrower segments and to address issues in niche markets more, much more than we have in the past. So the first book was really about how influence changes when all of these new voices come online and can publish to a worldwide audience. The second book is much more of a hands-on guide on how to make sense of that and how to make it work for you. And that really was based much of it on my years of experience as an editor, because the tools that marketers and business people can use now to gain an audience and to produce compelling content really haven't changed. The tools that work for editors also work for other people.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, the major TV networks are losing advertising now that car companies and other businesses are in this economic crunch. How do you see that affecting the media landscape?
Well, things are only going to get worse. Unfortunately, looking to newspapers specifically, the businesses that have tended to support newspapers, which have been automotive sales, real estate, and department stores, are collapsing faster than other segments of the economy. So you see dramatic downturns in real estate sales, for example, is not good news for the industry. Financial services companies are major advertisers on television. The drop-off in financial services advertising won't help them either. It's just unfortunate. It's a perfect storm that's hitting the mainstream media industry right now, where not only is their value proposition deteriorating, but in the case of printed publications, there's actually a green issue. The use of printed matter is politically unpopular, and then you have, on top of that, their advertising base is being eroded very rapidly by the economic downturn. So many things are going the wrong way for print media right now that it's really a painful thing to follow.
Well, I mentioned your blog, the newspaperdeathwatch.com. How fast do you think newspapers will go down, and do you have predictions of which might go first or which types might disappear first?
Well, the Christian Science Monitor did it voluntarily, which I think was to their credit. They have taken the bull by the horns and said, we are not going to expect to see much growth in the print business, and so we're going to start to wind that down fairly aggressively. There was a case just a couple of months ago where the Newark Star-Ledger drew a line in the sand with its unions and basically said, we're going out of business on January 9th unless we get concessions. Now, of course, they were holding a gun to the head of the unions, and they did get those concessions, but I think that was the first example of a major newspaper really setting a date when they would disappear. I think you're going to see that happen much more quickly. I expect during 2009 we will see the first major daily newspaper in the U.S. Literally go out of business, or at least as a print entity, will probably continue online. And I think we'll see that happen with increasing rapidity in the coming 5 years. It'll become almost commonplace within the next 5 years to see major metropolitan newspapers exiting or significantly downscaling their print businesses and essentially moving to an all-online model. That has to happen in order for their brands to survive and for them to become economically sustainable, though.
Well, closing out, Paul, do you have any tips for our listeners who might want to get involved with Citizen Media?
Well, Citizen Media, it's hard to say that it's a defined category. I mean, anyone who is blogging or Twittering or posting their videos on YouTube is essentially part of the media now. So it's a question of how do you use it. I mean, media broadly defined is simply communications. It's a type of communications, and anybody who uses these tools is playing the role of the media. I think it's interesting how many people are now defining the media in these micro segments, so that which interests them. They become reporters for a couple of hours or a day or two to report on something that interests them. They're going to a conference, they go to an event or a concert, or they attend a rally, and they document what they're seeing through whatever means is available to them. And those people are becoming essentially citizen journalists, but they may only do that for a few hours. So I think the message would be that there is it's a wide open market now. If you want to practice journalism, there are a great many ways to do it now. The difference is that you won't get the big audiences that you had in the past, because we're moving out of a mass market world into a niche market world. And that's perfectly okay if you define your audience as being that group of people that shares your intense interest in something. I think it can be quite a fulfilling pastime or a career, even if you don't think of the be-all and end-all of journalism as writing for the New York Times.
Well, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, a sort of narrow band a radio program for those interested in the environment and the economy. And we've been talking with longtime print journalist Paul Gillen about the death of the old media and the birth of something completely different. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Alex.
In Canada, if you don't like the bias of your local newspaper, you can subscribe to their competition. Oh, wait, that's owned by the same company, Canwest, the media giant that runs newspapers across the country, plus a national television network, cable channels, and much more. Canwest also owns Network 10 in Australia. The story of media domination in Canada involves many of our favorite people, from the convicted newspaper magnate Conrad Black to the rulers of the world, Goldman Sachs. Here is an interview about Canwest staggering under the debt of their own push for domination done by the Red Eye Collective of CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Pardon the sometimes scratchy telephone line, but the story is just too good to leave alone.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
It has become routine to see stock prices tumbling on the market, credit drying up, and the largest of corporations and investment institutions on the edge of collapse. But the financial problems of Canwest, while accentuated by the current generalized economic crisis, predate this. To discuss the financial situation of Canwest, I'm joined on the phone from Texas by Mark Edge. He is an academic, journalist, and author of Aspernation, published by New Star Books. And we reached Mark this morning in Texas, where he now teaches. Good morning, Mark, and welcome to Red Eye.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, you have some stocks, I gather, from an article you recently wrote for the Tie, stocks in Canwest. How are you doing today?
Well, not too bad today. The markets are closed, but it's down to a penny stock, unfortunately. I've been following the fortunes of Canwest for some number of years now, and a couple of years ago their stock was trading about $15, and recently it had slipped below $2, and I figured maybe that was a good time to buy, but unfortunately it's just kept going down, so the question I keep asking myself is, how low can it go?
So you're saying it was much higher when they bought out Conrad Black's newspaper chain, the stock value was what again?
Well, a number of years ago it was even up in the $20-$22 range, but it's been a steady decline ever since they bought the Southern newspapers from Conrad Black. A lot of people think that the business strategy that they have of media convergence, that is combining newspaper and television holdings, is not a viable one, and they also took on a lot of debt, first in buying the newspapers, which they did at the top of the market in the year 2000, just before the technology bubble burst and the 9/11 sent the markets into a long decline, and they recently bought the 13 cable channels from Alliance Atlantis, also at the top of the market, and they seem to suffer from bad timing as much as anything.
So in all these purchases that they made initially for the Black chain and then later for television cable, what sort of, when you say a lot of money, what kind of money are we really talking about?
Well, we're talking billions with a B. The Southern newspapers set Canwest back about $3.2 billion, and the Alliance Atlantis channels were something like $2.3 billion, but most of that was contributed, of course, by the U.S. investment bank Goldman Sachs, which came in for about two-thirds of the purchase, which was a level well in excess of what's supposed to be the limit on foreign media ownership in Canada, but despite that, nonetheless, the CRTC quickly rubber-stamped the deal. So, yes, we're talking big money here.
So when you say they had to pay out that kind of money, it wasn't money they had in their pockets. It must be money that they've borrowed on and as they say, leveraged.
Yes, exactly. And Izzy Asper, of course, the company founder, was an old tax lawyer, so he well understood that debt is not necessarily a bad thing, because, of course, you can write off the cost of your borrowings against your earnings, with the result, of course, that Canwest's expansion has been financed to a large extent by other Canadians, subsidized by other Canadians. But the problem is that if you get overextended, like CanWest is now, in a falling economy, they could be in big trouble because, of course, one of the first things to go in a downturn is advertising. It's a discretionary expenditure, and that's why media companies are inevitably hit first and hardest during any sort of a recession.
And when we say that they've gone into debt for this, what do they actually owe in debt? What is known about their debt, and when do they have to, so to speak, pay up?
Well, the latest figure I've seen is that they're now in debt to the tune of about $3.7 billion. They had whittled that down before the Atlantis purchase to about $2.4 billion. It had been up around $3 billion after they bought the Southern newspapers from Conrad Black. So they have lots of notes and bonds out there, and apparently a lot of them don't come due until about 2012. But they also have a pending merger with Goldman Sachs, which is set for sometime in 2011. The cable channels that they bought in partnership, that enterprise is set to merge with CanWest Broadcast Networks, Global Television, the E Network, and the final division of ownership of that combined enterprise will depend on the revenues of each. So if CanWest's broadcasting revenues decline sufficiently, they could actually end up in a minority ownership of the new enterprise, which could be mostly American-owned.
And would that would be of CanWest as a whole, then, being mainly American-owned, or just the cable?
It would just be their broadcasting and cable television assets. The publications are in a separate company called CanWest Publications, what was formerly known as Southern Newspapers. So at least we don't have to worry about the newspaper side being mostly American-owned. But certainly the broadcasting side, which, like I say, there are supposed to be limits on foreign ownership of broadcasting in Canada, and majority ownership by Americans, I think, would be a clear violation of those limits.
And, of course, Goldman Sachs is part of the benefactor of the $700 billion American taxpayer compensation for bad money they have.
Yes, they're one of the largest Wall Street players, and they're implicated in the latest market downturn, that's for sure.
So given this very touchy and precarious financial situation that you've outlined of CanWest, how are the major stockholders, namely the family of Izzy Asper, Leonard David, and Gail Asper, how are they responding to this, both in terms of any comments they're making, but also in terms of steps they might be taking with regards to shoring up their economic well-being?
Well, they are now seeking, it seems, outside financing. They just sold another sizable chunk of shares to an investment bank called Fairfax Holdings, which now owns about one-fifth, I believe, of CanWest's common shares. The Asper family, they control the company through ownership of the preferred shares, which are multiple voting shares. So there's no danger that they could lose voting control over the company, but they're certainly seeking outside investment from people like Fairfax, and now they're having to sell it at quite a bargain rate. So some people are betting that in the long term, CanWest is going to come back and be financially viable. And if they do weather this economic storm, they probably will. The question is what happens in the meantime. And they have, I noticed, been cutting back on the distribution of their National Post in some of the prairie provinces, which makes it hardly a national newspaper anymore. There's been some speculation they may even sell the National Post because it is a money loser and has been for the 10 years since Conrad Black founded it. There was some talk that they would sell their Australian television holdings, but they decided not to last year, and I think now that they're kind of regretting that decision.
Regretting because?
Well, they could have got a good price for it a year ago. Now, with the economic downturn, they'd be selling it at a fire sale price.
So is the whole question of their concentrated ownership really at risk? You mentioned perhaps selling off the National Post. Is that part of a pressure that would be on them to fragment the conglomerate they've assembled over the previous years?
Yes, I'm sure there's some pressure on them from shareholders, also from their banks. Because with the fall of their share price, now what's called their debt-to-equity ratio is very large. They have a large debt and now a small market capitalization or equity, so their bankers could have some say in this too. Canwest is supposed to be reporting its fourth quarter earnings in about a week. In fact, I see they've got a conference call with investors scheduled for next Friday, and I might just be listening in to that myself on the internet.
Yes, I heard an interview with David Asper, and he was asked on the finances of the corporation. It was an interview based on their cutting, as you mentioned, the production of the Post and distribution of a print edition in Saskatchewan and in Manitoba. And when he was asked about finances, his voice became rather testy, and he said, "My brother's responsible for that. He'll be speaking later."
Yes, well, David, of course, looks after mostly the newspaper side. He's the chairman of the National Post, effectively its publisher, and Leonard looks after a global television, and I'm sure they've had more than a few heated conversations on what direction that they should go with all of this.
Lastly, is this a crisis or difficulty, financial difficulty of Canwest, really unique to them, or is it also impacting other media in Canada?
Oh, no. Like I say, in a financial downturn, media are hit first and hardest because, like I say, they're dependent on advertising revenue, which is usually one of the first things to go down. All media companies have been suffering, but Canwest has been suffering more than most, like I say, because of their financial exposure, the fact that they're as overextended as they are, and they're all quite often are casualties in these sorts of markets. So Canwest could well become a casualty if it doesn't do something fast to right the sinking ship.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure as well. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My guest has been Mark Edge. He's an academic, a journalist, and he's author of Asper Nation, a book on Canwest, published by New Star Books.
Canwest's efforts to dominate mass media in Canada is just a profile of the other titans who grab up independent content all over the world. Egos like Robert Murdoch and Sumner Redstone want to fill your mind with big business propaganda. They may trip over their own piles of money as they fall out the door. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Don't forget the tons of free audio downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. Look for our audio on demand menu to access the net's largest collection of free green audio at ecoshock.org. You can also get this program. I'm Alex Smith, and who knows what will happen next. What major corporate icon will become a government subsidiary by the time I talk to you next week? What country will declare bankruptcy next? How will you survive it all now that the food chips have stopped? Next week on Radio EcoShock, we'll tear into the subject of storing a little food for the apocalypse. Meanwhile, hey, enjoy yourselves. Get out and dance if you are able. Ta-ta. We'll go out with Secrets by Xavier Rudd.
Seeking truth and change worldwide, coming up slowly, and many more seem to be opening their eyes. Coming up slowly, centuries of twisted truth and lies. Coming up slowly, many people, many places, sick and tired. Coming up slowly.
Hey!
Mister, you see, I've seen this.